Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians and social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
Just by way of some background, the genesis of this presentation only goes back 10 years. So I had just graduated from WashU, and I was on a job market, and I was giving a job talk to a search committee, and I was going through just my area of academic interest, spirituality and religion, and just the various components to my overarching research trajectory. And when I was finished, one of the persons in the search committee just said, you know, that spirituality and religion stuff is fine, but what about social justice? You know, what about social justice? And I was kind of piqued by that because I thought there was a number of points of contact between my work and social justice, but it clearly wasn't resonating with this particular individual. So as a result, I started to think more deeply about social justice and the integration of faith and my interest, academic interest, spirituality, and religion, how that relates to social justice. So this presentation is the result of that 10-year thought process. So what are we going to cover today? Well, we'll talk briefly about the mission and values of social work, and one of those values is social justice. Then we'll talk about human rights as a way to operationalize the sort of nebulous construct of social justice. Then we'll talk about the source of social justice, or source of human rights, where human rights come from. And we'll talk about the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and in particular Article 18, which is a definition or conceptualization of the right to religious freedom. Then we'll take a look at the status of religious freedom and persecution around the world, and we'll talk very briefly about some strategies for addressing persecution. Then we'll talk about the challenges and the opportunities that religious persecution presents us. Okay, so two academics were discussing their idea of an important mission for their profession, and then after a long time, one said to another, well, if it made any sense, that would be a very powerful idea. So academics kind of get a bad rep sometimes for having these sort of like esoteric ideas that don't make any sense. And I don't think that's true for social work. Our mission, our value system really does make sense. And I think we can be very proud about that fact. So what is the mission of social work? Well, it's to enhance human well-being and to help meet the basic needs of all people, particularly the needs of people who are vulnerable, oppressed, and living in poverty. Now, where does that value statement or that mission statement come from? Well, it's rooted in a certain set of values. And here are some of them. So one value is the dignity and worth of the person. And that's fleshed out in the ethical principle that social workers respect the inherent dignity and worth of people. Another value is service. And that's fleshed out in the sense that social workers' primary goal is to help people in need and to address social problems. But these values should speak to us as believers, because David Sherwood and others have been teaching throughout the years that the values that animate the social work profession come from the Christian narrative. So social work emerged from Christians that were seeking to help other individuals. And so these are Christian values and have also been imported into the code of ethics. Another Christian value slash social work value is social justice, and that's operationalized in the sense that social workers challenge social injustice. So that's all very well and good. So I think most of us affirm social justice. But then the question arises, well, what is social justice? Like, how do you operationalize that concept? So Hunter, in his seminal work, Culture Wars, talks about these two conflicting worldviews, the progressive worldview and the orthodox worldview. And these worldviews have different understandings of what is right, what is just, what is moral. And if you read the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, you'll see two different understandings of what is just and right laid out. Similarly, if you watch Fox News or CNN or MSNBC, you'll see very different understandings of what is right, what is just. This graphic kind of illustrates that point. So we see the character here, and he's going to Woolley's Dictionary. He wants to know, what's the definition of a religious cult? And then he sees that the answer is the church down the street from yours. Now, if you're at the church down the street, then it's the other church. It's always the other person. It's always the other person that's wrong. So this kind of illustrates the point. How do we find some sort of transcendent plane, some sort of position through which we're able to assess social justice in a fair way that can be agreed upon, regardless of where we're coming from in terms of our presuppositional frameworks? Well, one option is human rights. So human rights have been defined as characteristics that are necessary in order for us to live as human beings. But human rights are posited to be universal. In other words, they apply to people across cultures and across governmental structures. So they apply to everyone throughout the world. So if you hold this notion of human rights as a way to operationalize social justice, it makes a nice, tight sort of framework. So you identify human rights violations, and then once you identify, you advocate to restore the rights that have been violated. Now, where human rights come from, traditionally there's been at least three sort of suggestions where human rights originate. And the traditional suggestion is that they come from God. So the kind of the flow of logic is here. So this would be like within the context of a Christian worldview. So humans are made in the image of God. As a result, they have inherent dignity and worth. And the United Association of Canada points out that this innate dignity and worth results in certain sort of basic human rights. And then because the origin of these human rights comes from a transcendent source, God, therefore they apply naturally to all humans because God is external to human culture. So this view is found in the Declaration of Independence. Most of you are probably familiar with this. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. But also, this view is found in our era, too. So Martin Luther King, in his classic Letters from the Birmingham Jail, he said that a just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God. So King also saw human rights as having their origin in God. Now, two other theories are natural law theory. So that sort of theory says that by looking at nature, we can sort of deduce human rights. And then the third view is human rights come from humans. They're socially constructed. And so, for instance, Alan Dershowitz says that through the experience of moral wrongs or injustice, human beings can understand what rights are, what is right conduct. But in practice, these kind of views overlap somewhat, but they're all sort of fairly widely held at different strata in society. So another quick distinction that I'll make is between negative rights and positive rights. So negative human rights are classic rights, and they exist naturally, apart from government interaction. So examples would be freedom of speech, freedom of association, and we'll see freedom of religion. So governments don't have to do anything about these rights. They just exist in nature. So government has to be restrained from violating these rights, hence the term negative rights. Now, positive human rights are a more recent innovation. So that would include things like education, living wage, and health care. Now, those are a little bit more controversial because they require a certain level of national wealth in order to provide those kind of rights. So how do we define social justice? We can use human rights, but how do we define human rights? So there's lots of different human rights codes. So if you talk to five different people and ask them to list human rights, you probably come up with five different answers. So one way to define human rights is via the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So this is the first and most widely accepted human rights protocol. It was developed in the aftermath of World War II. I think what happened to the Jewish people really sort of shocked the international community. And as a result, people wanted to sort of figure out what are sort of the basic essential human rights that would allow people to live together in peace and harmony. And so they came up with this Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It was adopted without dissent by the General Assembly in 1948, and it's been enforced ever since. Now, just to let you know, this notion of human rights, even though there's wide support for human rights, it's not an unchallenged entity. So probably the most cogent challenge has come from postmodernism. So there's a number of definitions for postmodernism, but one of the definitions is just the rejection of meta-narratives. So postmodernists would not believe in universals. So they would argue that justice is local, situational, and contextual. So there's been some counter-arguments that have been raised to postmodernists critique it. So one of the counterarguments is that people have pointed out that postmodernists themselves actually resort to the use of universals to describe their own version of social justice. It's kind of like the people, there are no absolutes. So that itself is an absolute statement. And so therefore, it's logically self-defeating. So for postmodernists to argue that there are no absolutes, that's self-defeating as well. Then postmodernists would also say that in each local situation, what you would do is deconstruct the dominant discourse and then allow subjugated voices to be heard. But they apply that universally to all cultures. So that also is, in effect, an absolute. Then another critique that's been advanced against the postmodernist perspective in favor of human rights is just on an emotional level, that people are uncomfortable with the notion that there's no sort of like baseline for human behavior, that sort of anything goes, that it's okay to torture people. So people are troubled by that, and people feel that there should be some sort of minimal standard, and then like, well, what is that standard? And then the third critique is that most nations, in fact, basically every nation, has signed the Universal Declaration. So even if you believe, as postmodernists would, that social justice is specific and contextual, nations have said that this applies to our specific nation. So by signing that document, they're saying that it applies to us. So all we're essentially doing is just holding nations accountable to what they themselves have said is applicable to their specific culture. So the Universal Declaration talks about religion in a number of different places, but the most articulate and forceful expression is found in Article 18. So this says that everyone has a right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change one's belief or religion, and freedom either alone or in community with others, in public or private, to manifest one's religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. So it's interesting that this right also covers the right of atheists. So when this right was hammered out, there was a number of communist, atheist nations at the table, and so they made sure that it included religion or belief. So this is a really broad, overarching right that has a lot of salience. Now, Forum 18 is a Norwegian human rights organization, and they provided this sort of nice, succinct summary of what this Article 18 means. So they summarize Article 18 as the right to believe, worship, and witness, or to share your faith, the right to change one's belief or religion, and the right to join together with others to express your belief or religion. So I think that's a different way of looking at it that's often helpful. Okay, why is religious freedom important? Well, religious freedom has long been considered one of the most basic fundamental human rights. So religion typically entails core inner convictions about ultimate metaphysical concerns. And this next sort of graphic illustrates that. So the character, he's got a flower, he's going to the cemetery entrance, and then he lays the flower at the cross, at the gravestone, looks over, sees the exit sign, points the exit sign up, signifying that that's not the ultimate resting place. In this other graphic, you see here the character looking into Lilly's dictionary to try to determine what's the definition of life. And the answer is eternity 101. And you can see he's kind of like shocked by that definition. So, within many faith traditions, life is perceived as sort of a testing ground for what comes later. And the real action happens in eternity. And therefore, when you violate someone's religious rights, when you restrict them from operationalizing their religious faith, it's experienced as a really profound and really sacred violation. Okay, the second reason why religious freedom is important is because religion's freedom, this is a more utilitarian reason. So the first reason is more personal. This one is more utilitarian, also more of a macro level. Religious freedom often precedes and fosters the development of other rights, including democracy itself. So it's a historical fact that religious freedom was the first freedom in the pantheon of human rights. And people can argue, well, it's just a historical accident that religion happened first. But we've also seen that in our day and age, too. So, for instance, Within our lifetime, there's been revolutions in the Philippines and also in Poland that were really sparked by religious freedom. So Poland in particular is held up as an example where like Walesa and the Solidarity Movement, even though people associate that movement with labor unions, was really a religious movement. And that, by having that freedom of association, those Christians were able to move Poland from being a communist society to being a free democratic society. And that was sort of the linchpin, some historians argue, in terms of changing the nation, changing the Soviet Union, and the collapse of the Soviet Union. So these are correlations with religious freedom. Now, correlation is not causation, but it's still interesting. So we find that religious freedom is correlated with a lot of positive constructs that we as social workers would be interested in, including gender empowerment, lower percent of GDP spent on military, longevity of democracy, lower levels of armed conflict, lower poverty. So going on, higher levels of religious freedom are associated with economic freedom, higher percent of GDP spent on public health, also associated with overall livability, lower inflation, lower income equality, and higher earning income for women and for men. So now we're going to move on to nations that are ranked highest in terms of religious freedom. So this comes from the Center for Religious Freedom at the Hudson Institute. So I've reproduced this on this other graphic so you can kind of see more clearly where these nations are. So we see that Estonia is an exemplar of religious freedom. So one of the things that's interesting about this is just the diversity that appears on this map. So Japan is primarily a Buddhist nation, at least in terms of its background. Estonia and Hungary are former Soviet satellites, so at one time they were under an atheist leadership. Mali and Senegal are primarily Islamic. And then most of these other nations, Ireland, etc., are primarily either Protestant Christian or Catholic Christian. So we see that sort of regardless of the faith background, that it's possible to generate a culture that supports religious freedom. Also, there's a lot of income disparities here. So because religious freedom is a negative human right, all government has to do is sort of stay out of the way and sort of promote a positive culture. It doesn't require high levels of GDP in order to generate a culture that supports religious freedom. We see that here. So you've got very rich nations like the USA, and you've got very poor nations like Botswana and India. So again, religious freedom is not dependent upon income that the nation generates. So that should give us some hope when it comes to advocating for religious freedom. So religious freedom may be a good thing, but unfortunately it's also kind of a marginalized human right. So there's been very little attention that's been devoted to religious freedom. So if you take a look at non-governmental organizations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, traditionally these organizations have devoted very little of their time and energy to sort of highlighting abuses to religious freedom. Also academic researchers. This is maybe a handful of academic researchers in the U.S. that are actually devoting their careers to sort of exposing this problem. Media outlets, like I'm a big fan of Law and Order, and I like to watch that, and they talk about how their news stories are ripped from the headlines, but I'm still waiting to see a whole show dedicated to religious freedom. It's just not an issue that media tends to focus on. Also, human rights-friendly states, like the United States of America, tend to be a pretty positive human rights-friendly nation. But in its dealings with other countries, it often sort of downplays human rights interests in favor of economic interests. This next graphic kind of illustrates that point. So we see Uncle Sam, he's kind of like leaning back in his chair, he's kind of watching the news, and news comes on, China kills unwanted children in their orphanages. Next bulletin, China tortures and executes political prisoners. And Uncle Sam is still there, just, you know, laid back, blasé, no reaction. China uses slave labor. Again, no reaction. And then China pirates American CDs.
Uncle Sam hops out of his chair, and he's just livid with anger. That's a moral outrage, he said. So this cartoon was written to sort of dramatize the fact that the United States, in its dealings with China, raised the whole issue of pirated software, but was totally silenced on human rights abuses. So it's like, you know, where's your value system? What are you sort of prioritizing in your dealings? Not that the U.S. should necessarily go into other countries and use force, but just in a civil manner. If you're going to raise commercial interests, why can't you raise human rights interests as well? So the neglect has led to religious persecution and actually dramatic increasing religious persecution, as we'll talk about a little bit later. So how do we define religious persecution? So you can think about religious persecution as severe discrimination that stems from an individual's faith. So we're all sort of have a multiplicity of identities, gender, race, ethnicity. All these factors enter into oppressed populations and whether people are discriminated or not. So one way to sort of parse out religious discrimination is ask yourself, if the person had a different faith or no faith, how would that impact their discrimination? If they had a different faith or no faith and discrimination lessened, and that's sort of we use that to sort of assess the magnitude of religious discrimination. And in 2002, the U.S. government estimated over half the world's population lives in nations that severely restrict or prohibit freedom to believe or practice. So that's kind of out of date now. And most recent research has been done by Brian Grimm at the Pew Forum. So it's also, in addition to being the most recent, I think it's also the most exhaustive as well. So Grimm has looked at 198 nations or self-governing territories. So basically, it's 100% of the world's population, pretty close to it. It includes every single member of the United Nations, except for North Korea, where they were unable to get any information at all, because it's just a closed society. So this is global restrictions on religion. So the good news is the percentage of countries that have high or very high restrictions on religion is roughly a third. But the bad news is that most of the people live in those countries. So we see over here that 70% of the world's population live in nations with very high or high restrictions on religion. So this is the 25 most populous nations. Can everyone see this in the back, this graphic? I hope it doesn't wash out. So these are the 25 most populous nations. And so like China, you can see down there, and India up there are the biggest nations. They have the biggest circle. Now down here on this line, we have government restrictions. And on this line, we have social hostilities, or social restrictions. So government restrictions would be situations like where the government says that you can't build a church or a mosque or a synagogue, or you have to register with the government in order to have a job, or in more severe cases, the government will bulldoze your church. And social restrictions are sort of non-governmental actions. They're just like social discrimination. So maybe someone would fire you for your religious belief system, or maybe a mob might come to your house and burn your house down or burn your church down or something like that. So we can see that if you put a regression line on there, there will be a correlation between government restrictions and social restrictions. But it's also interesting in terms of the distinctions too. So we see China over on the other end has very high government restrictions. And they're actually very open about that. So they don't want to see the collapse of their atheistic, communistic, authoritarian system in the same way that the Soviet Union did. And so they've actually said that we don't want to see replicated in China what happened in Poland. So we want to keep a very tight lid on religious freedom. But there's not a whole lot of social hostilities in China. So in other words, the people themselves are fairly accepting about people from different faiths. And then we have like India up here, where there's high government restrictions, but not excessively high. But there's a lot of social hostilities. There's all kinds of cases of just mob violence against Christians and Sikhs and Muslims, which tend to be minorities in most locations in India. And then down here you see Brazil, which is the biggest country in South America. So very low social restrictions and very low moderate restrictions. I think this is roughly around 2006, and we'll come back to this graphic a little bit later. So who experiences religious persecution? Well, basically, members of every single faith. There's no faith group that's exempt from religious persecution. So typically, it's a minority, though, a minority faith that with little or social or political or economic power. So the typical victim of religious persecution, looking at it through a global lens, would be an Asian woman living in poverty, and typically just unimaginable poverty from a Western standpoint. And the most widely persecuted group are Christians, and the second most widely persecuted group are Muslims. So this is the number of countries where religious groups were harassed, and we see that Christians are number one. In 130 countries, there's roughly 200 countries in the world, and then Muslims in 117 countries. So this next graphic kind of expands on that previous one a little bit. So we see, again, Christians are persecuted in 130 countries, but it's also broken out by government harassment and social harassment. So Christians are government harassed in 104 and socially harassed in 100. Now, what's particularly interesting about this is how people from the Jewish faith, their pattern's a little bit different from both Muslims and Christians. So with Jews, they face far more social hostility than they do government hostility, which is an interesting point. So this is harassment of particular religious groups by region. And so we kind of go across. So it's like Christians, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, and others. So this would be Christians and Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, and others. So you see that in the Americas and sub-Saharan Africa, the level of religious restrictions is comparatively low. But in the Middle East and North Africa, it's quite high. So what's particularly interesting about this is that now this Middle East, North Africa area, that's primarily Islamic. But the most widely persecuted group are disfavored Muslims. So that would be, again, minority Muslims. So for instance, let's say in Iran or Iraq, that would be Shia Muslims. In Saudi Arabia, So in Iran, Iraq, it would be probably Sunni Muslims that would be discriminated against because Shiites are the majority there. And then in Saudi Arabia, it would be probably Shiite Muslims that would be discriminated against because they're the majority, they're the minority there, and Sunnis are the majority in Saudi Arabia. So as, unfortunately, as I alluded to before, religious persecution is increasing. So this is, everyone that studies this issue that I've read has said that, and that includes the United Nations. So back in 2003, the High Commissioner for Human Rights reported a global increase in hatred, intolerance, and discrimination directed towards religious believers. And just this present year, 2011, the United Nations Human Rights Council expressed deep concern at the growing impediments to exercising the right to religious freedom. They went on to observe that violence and acts of terrorism targeting religious minorities were increasing around the world. So, Graham and Pew Forum looked at the past, well, not really the past 3 years, but a three-year window from 06 to 09. This is the most recent data that was available. It's just published in this past year. This just takes time to collect the data when you're looking at 200 countries. So within this three-year window, Graham found that in 12% of the countries, restrictions were increasing. So that's not too bad. But again, we run into this problem where it's roughly, that's where most of the people live. So, or at least a disproportionate amount of the people live. So roughly a third of the people in the past 3 years, or from the 06 to 09 window, experienced a rising level of religious restrictions. So that's roughly a billion people. And now you may wonder, well, how widespread is religious belief around the world? Well, roughly 9 out of 10 people around the world would affirm some sort of allegiance to some kind of religious system. So we're talking about a lot of people having their rights restricted. So this is this graph, again, the 25 most populous nation, but it incorporates the most recent data and the change over that time period. So you can see the original data. Remember, China was down here, and now it's since moved up there. So you can see sort of these faded circles. I hope you can see that with at least some sort of visibility. The faded circles represent the original data that I showed you, and this darker circles represent the change over time. Now, most of the problem is really in that circle. So that's where either there's very high governmental restrictions or very high social restrictions or some combination of the two. And so we see that Vietnam has increased. You can see these red arrows, they pop up for a second. China has increased over the last 3 years, or again, I'm using the last 3 years, but really it's the 06 to 09 window. Russia has increased. Nigeria, you may have seen in the news, Nigeria, northern Nigeria, there have been a lot of problems with Muslims trying to impose their own version of Sharia law on disfavored Muslims and also on Christians. So Egypt has increased. This took place before the so-called Arab Spring, although the Arab Spring is not working out particularly favorably for the Coptic Christians who are living in Egypt. So if this was done in this presently, Egypt would be even further, but it would increase in terms of social hostilities, I think, not necessarily the government restrictions. So also outside that circle, so we see the UK has moved up. That's because there's been an increase in anti-Semitism during a three-year period. Thailand moved up. France moved over. So France didn't increase in terms of the social hostilities, but France passed government restrictions saying that if you're a Muslim or a Jew, or even some Christians, if you can't wear symbols or burqas that sort of allow you to exhibit your faith. So these are countries with very high, so these are sort of like the top 10. These are the countries that have the highest government restrictions on religion. Then the little triangle means that during the three-year window examined in this study, that the level of restrictions increased. So we see like Egypt, Iran, Saudi Arabia on this list. Most of these nations probably won't surprise you. What's curious, though, is that even though we saw before there's a correlation between social hostilities and government hostilities, it's not a direct correlation by any means. I think the only nation that's on both of these is Egypt. So here's a map right here. And so the light is very low levels of government restriction. This is just government restrictions. But I'll show you a graphic that deals with social hostilities in a second. And then the darker to very red is very high hostilities. So we see that, you know, in the Americas, that there's very few, relatively few restrictions on religion. And then when you come over here, North Africa, it's much higher. So this is the various regions. And so this is a score in which 0 equals almost no government restrictions, and then 10 is a great amount of government restrictions. Then so we have the median, so 50% of the nations are below 5.4, and 50% of the nations are above 5.4. And so you can see that from the change from 08 to 09, just the change in 1 year, we see that the median actually has moved in favor of increasing government restrictions. It's also moved in the Asia-Pacific area. Then it's actually, things have gotten better down here. So that's good news. But again, you can see in Sub-Saharan Africa, the median is very low. So overall in Sub-Saharan Africa, there's relatively few government restrictions. But the band is quite long, indicating that there are countries that within Sub-Saharan Africa that do restrict religious freedom. So this is a graphic of social hostilities around the world. So again, the same thing, very high. So one of the things that's interesting here is that the U.S. comes out, it doesn't come out low on social hostilities, it comes out moderate. The reason for that is that there's hundreds of hate crimes, just over 1,000 hate crimes based on religion that occur every year in the U.S. But still, it's much better relative to some of these other nations. So you can see Nigeria there, Egypt, India, Pakistan. And again, you look at by region, and again, the Middle East, North Africa, and then other regions moving down to the Americas tend to do much better in terms of religious freedom. So now the reason I showed you that graphic earlier about how it's, even though this area is primarily Muslim, there's no reason why Islamic societies have to restrict religion. It's possible to develop an Islamically-based society that protects and nurtures and promotes religious freedom. So this is a correlation between restrictions and conflict. So on this side we have religious violence, and on this side you have legal and policy restrictions. And as you can see, there's a strong correlation between those two. So we have like North Africa at the very high end, you have the Americas down here. Now, it's a correlation. Correlation doesn't say anything about causation. So these authors put together a structural equation modeling that sort of kind of teases out the direction. So they control for a whole host of factors that may influence this. And what they found is that the social restriction of religion tends to lead to government restriction. So if there's sort of a groundswell of support for restricting religious minorities in a nation, that tends to lead to governmental policies that restrict religious freedom. And that leads to violence. So people feel oftentimes an ethical obligation, a metaphysical impetus to sort of operationalize their religious faith. They feel that they're called to in light of eternity. And so they have to resort to violence because they have no other way really of sort of dealing with the situation. And that results in more social pressure on the group, which results in more government restrictions. And so it can be a very vicious cycle. But it's important to intervene in this cycle to prevent the cycle of violence. So what can we do about religious persecution? Now, I don't have time to go into all these different sort of strategies, but I wanted to make you aware of them and to let you know that there's going to be an article, This Faith in This Talk, coming out in Social Christianity. And it will include all these different strategies as well as some other resources that you may find helpful. I'm just going to touch on a few. So one is just to adopt a persecuted believer. So in my class, I teach a class on spirituality. One of the assignments I give is to ask people to pick a particular person who's experiencing persecution in the world. So the student can select the individual. They choose the faith tradition, the person, and then they're responsible to sort of advocate for that. Either contact an embassy of the nation where the individual is being oppressed, and or contact a U.S. representative and ask that person to put some pressure on this foreign government. So that's one sort of strategy that we can do. It's fairly simple at the micro level. And a lot of times that produces dramatic changes. People have actually been freed from jail as a result of this kind of pressure. Now, another strategy, just kind of being the top one here, is to document and disseminate accounts of the positive value of religious freedom. So because there are so few academics working in this area, there's a real need for people to sort of take the bull by the horns and sort of like produce some sound academic research. So what's happened in Poland, for instance, and the Philippines and other nations where religious freedom has sparked tremendous democratic change, that doesn't really appear in social work literature for some reason. So if you're here and perhaps you're a student, I would encourage you to think about maybe dedicating your career to this. You know, go see Tanya Bryce at Baylor. And I'm not affiliated with Baylor, so this is not like an advertisement for Baylor, but I know Tanya is a great researcher. And she can teach you some good qualitative research skills to be able to go and document this sort of like systematic change that's happened for good, where religious freedom has been allowed to flourish. And also, if you're a faculty member too, I would encourage you to think about writing about this issue. There's just a whole lot that needs to be done. So it's a wonderful opportunity if you're looking for a new direction for your research career. There's lots of opportunities there. Okay, so on the top here, it says monitor. This stands for the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, or Organizational Drift. So, in 1998, there was legislation passed that established this commission. And the role of this commission is to sort of monitor U.S. foreign policy to make sure that at least one concern on the table, beside all these other economic interests, one concern is religious freedom. But this organization is pulled in all kinds of different directions, so it's important to sort of monitor it for organizational grip to make sure it maintains fidelity with its underlying mission. Now, we could use these kind of commissions in other nations. So Canada right now, the government of Canada is actually considering implementing a similar kind of commission. And, of course, it's raising all kinds of ruckus, and people are worried about all the damage this commission might do. But it could also do a lot of potential for good, too. So I would encourage you, if you're a Canadian or if you're from some other nation, that you would sort of think about maybe advocating that your government would adopt a similar type of commission that would encourage the government to consider religious freedom as part of its role when it's dealing with other nations. Okay, so there's some challenges when it comes to advocacy, too. There's kind of like, when talking to people, there's two sort of rationales that people often bring up to sort of like prevent people from maybe advocating for religious freedom. And the first is what I'm calling cultural insider bias. But I didn't really know how to kind of describe this, but in talking to people, sometimes I get the sense that people are hesitant to advocate, particularly Christians, are hesitant to advocate for religious freedom because Christians are the people that need advocacy the most, and therefore Christians would benefit from this advocacy. And it's almost like people feel embarrassed about advocating for their own group, like somehow that's morally suspect to advocate for a group that you're a part of. So I'd like to present an argument against that particular argument. So one of the good things about postmodernism is illustrated that all people are biased in some way or another. And another good thing about postmodernism is illustrated that cultural insiders are often critical to addressing problems. We can't really understand problems without cultural insiders coming forward and kind of relating their perspective. But I really saw that when I was talking to a black friend who comes from one of the Caribbean nations. So this was a couple of years ago. I was asking him about his experience living in America, being a black man. So he was telling me that, when he was walking down this particular city where we were having lunch together, when he first moved to the U.S. in the 80s, that people would come up to him and whisper the N-word in his ear. So now, I would never know that. I'm not going to experience that as a white person. So without him sharing his perspective, I wouldn't even know that's a problem. And it's the same way with religious persecution. So without people sort of standing up and advocating for religious freedom, other people that just aren't in touch with this issue or doesn't resonate with them or it's not applicable to them because they're functionally secular, it's just not going to be aware of it. So we really have a responsibility to sort of speak up so other people of good faith and goodwill can address this problem. So we also offer like a very unique perspective. We're able to sort of discern when problems exist. And I really saw this a couple of years ago when the Sudan conflict was probably at the height of the situation. So I was out with two colleagues, a female and a male, and my one female friend was raising the Sudan issue, and she was talking about how bad it was. And she was curious as to sort of what was the underlying rationale that sparked this genocide. And since I know a little bit about Sudan, I was curious as to what my male colleague would say. He's someone that's very sort of widely read and has an opinion about most things. And so he said that the Sudan conflict was primarily ethnic. And so I almost fell off my chair. I couldn't believe it. So he kind of described that, and he did a very good job of describing the various ethnic groups. And it's true that ethnicity does play a role in the Sudan conflict, but that's not what it's about. It's actually about religion. So the whole reason that there was a war there is because the northern regime wanted to impose its version of Islam on disfavored Muslims and on Christians and animists that were primarily located in the south. And so if the northern regime was not trying to impose its version of Islam, there wouldn't be any sort of cultural war in Sudan. But that completely escaped my friend. And that's actually been one of the criticisms of U.S. foreign policy, is that they actually don't understand the motivations of religious people, and everything tends to get secularized. And as a result, people don't really understand what's going on. So I think that we as believers have a critical role to play to be able to sort of say, well, actually, that's not really what's happening, and here is what's happening. It's also interesting that this past year, the UN's Human Rights Council has stated that it sort of supports this notion of cultural insiders playing a role. So they've said that they welcome and encourage the continuing efforts of all actors in society. And they specifically mention bodies and groups based on religion. They want us to be a part of promoting freedom of religion and highlighting cases of religious intolerance, discrimination, and persecution. Also, the NASW Code of Ethics also calls us to fight religious discrimination as well. Okay, the second argument is sometimes sort of raised as a reason not to sort of advocate for people of faith, is what I'm calling the blood of the saints argument. And that comes from one of the early church fathers, Tertullian. So Christians at this day and age, around 300, 400 AD, were being persecuted. And so he wrote this sort of apologetic argument in defense of Christianity. And in the context of making that argument, he said, "We are not a new philosophy, but a divine revelation. That's why you can't exterminate us. The more you kill, the more we are. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church." So sometimes when I've suggested to people that this is religious persecution is an important issue, people kind of reference this argument in some kind of hazy way. It's almost like, well, if it's actually this persecution is good because the church is going to grow, it's almost like kind of like a funky like church growth strategy that people seem to have in their minds. But I want to suggest to you that first of all, it's not empirically true. It's not a church growth strategy, and also it's theologically questionable. So this is the last 100 years, the last century, and so this shows the stats. Most of these countries are from the Middle East. So you can see Syria, at the start of the turn of the last century, roughly 40% of the population was Christian. It's now down to about 10%. Iraq, from 35% to 5%. Palestine, 25% to 3%. Iran, 15% to 2%. Turkey, with the Armenian genocide, the Armenians were primarily Christians, roughly a third down to 1%. And North Korea once had a substantial population, and they're down to less than 1%. So in North Korea, if the government knows that your parents were Christians or your grandparents were Christians, supposedly what they'll do is they'll take you and put you in a re-education camp in order to try to eradicate that belief from your brain. I was talking to a friend of mine from Albania, and Albania, you may remember them, they were the country that felt that the Soviet Union was too liberal. So they were going to show you how to do atheism correctly. So they split from the Soviet Union, and they were officially atheist country, and they were ruthless in terms of eradicating religious believers. So my friend was telling me that his dad said if there was just any mention that you were a theist, they would just take you out and kill you, just get rid of you. So this whole like church growth argument, it just really doesn't play out. Now it's also a very theologically questionable. So last night we heard this quote from Matthew 25, and it's at Don Bartlett, and I just want to highlight that again. "I was in prison, and you came to visit me." So that's what Jesus said. And then people came up to Jesus and just said, "Well, hey, you know, when did we ever see you in prison?" And Jesus responded by saying that, "If you've done this for any of my followers, you've done this for me." And the context, as Dan talked about last night, was one of like helping people, you know, caring for people, food, clothes, you know, helping people in a material way. And that would include, I would think, advocating for people to be freed from persecution. So a little bit later on in Acts, we see that Peter's religious freedom rights were infringed upon, and he was imprisoned. And then Acts also tells us that the other Christian believers prayed for him, and I presume they have prayed for him to be free because an angel came and freed him. So that would suggest that being released is a good thing. Now, a little bit later in Acts, Paul is about to be tortured for his expression of his faith, and he didn't just kind of like sit back and take it. Instead, as he was about to be flogged, he said, "Wait a minute, is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen?" So he played the legal card that he had. And then people were, no, it's like, I paid a great price for my citizen. Paul, hey, I was born a citizen. So then people were like, well, we gotta stop this. Then also in Hebrews, it says, remember those in prison as if you were their fellow prisoners, and those who are mistreated as if you yourself were suffering. So this is a call for empathy. And so none of us, if we were in prison, would we want to be left there to be tortured or robbed? We would want people to advocate for us. And I just want to affirm that we really can make a difference at both the micro level and at the macro level. So at the micro level, as I've already mentioned, there's been lots of cases where people have advocated for individuals that are being persecuted for their faith, and governments have relented, and those people have gone free. And we can also make big changes at the macro level, too. So in 2002, Sudan was in the midst of a tremendous genocide. So according to U.S. government figures, over 2 million people were killed and 4 million people were displaced, primarily in the south, and again, primarily animist Christians and disfavored Muslims. And just it's just the litany of abuses that are just incredible. It's just like a systematic genocide. It was a very bad situation. And as a result of coordinated international effort, of people concerned about this issue, there was finally a peace accord that was brokered. And then this past year, there was a new nation that was founded, the Republic of South Sudan. And that nation, according to its constitution, is going to affirm religious freedom. So within the space of just one decade, we've gone from genocide to freedom. And that's a good thing. That's a really good thing. So just in closing, I'd like to leave you with the question that sort of started me down this journey. What about social justice? So many of you, probably most of you in this room, have some interest in spirituality and religion. And I would just ask you to think about how that's being operationalized, and if there's some way that you could operationalize that in a way that would sort of...
Thank you for joining us today for NECSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful, and that it will support your efforts to ethically integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NECSW activities and events, such as NECSW's upcoming convention 2011 in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, from October 20th to 23rd, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NECSW members, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the member section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NECSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NECSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening into our podcast session today.